Welcome to Guard's podcast, On Watch. We're going to be talking today about shipping's contribution to climate change and the Blue Visby solution. And I've got as guests today, Alice Larkin and Harris Zografakis. Alice is a professor in climate science and energy policy with the University of Manchester. And Harris is a partner in Stevenson Harwood, which is a law firm headquartered in London with offices in Europe and Asia. And while we get started, can I just have both of you explain your work as it relates to reducing greenhouse gas emissions in shipping? And we'll start with you, Alice.
Okay, so I've focused for a long time on decarbonisation more generally in relation to the wider energy system. So looking at the scale of the challenge. So when you interpret the Paris Climate Agreement in relation to the temperatures that are articulated in the Paris Climate Agreement, so minimizing emissions and ensuring that we don't exceed 2 degrees of warming, but trying very hard to avoid even a 1.5 degrees of warming above pre-industrial times. That delivers, you know, if you look at the science around that and what that means, it strongly relates to what's called cumulative emissions or a carbon budget. So in other words, there's a limit to how much greenhouse gas we can put into our atmosphere if we want to make sure that those temperature thresholds are not exceeded. Unfortunately, because in terms of action around delivering reductions in emissions has been really slow. And this is not just in the shipping sector, but in all sectors across the energy system. So if we got ourselves in gear basically in the 1990s and started to deliver, you know, meaningful emission reductions in that sort of a time frame from the 1990s up to now, we'd be well on the way to limiting our emissions to those kinds of thresholds. Unfortunately, because of the fact that these emissions accumulate, and that's because they're long lived in the atmosphere, and that makes a big difference to the science around how you actually deliver change in relation to climate change. It means that we've delayed action. We've not done what we needed to do to bring emissions down. And so the ask in terms of that limit to the carbon budget is now much greater. So in other words, it's a little bit like if you've got your salary for a month, and you've basically spent most of it in the first couple of days, and you're not going to have very much left for the rest of the month. And how that relates to shipping, and how my work relates to shipping, is that we look at the different sectors where there are particular challenges around how would you cut your emissions very rapidly in a very short space of time, given that big ask of the Paris Climate Agreement. So I've looked at shipping and aviation, because those are two interesting sectors from a research point of view, because their emissions are not the governance around those emissions are not dictated by national governments. They're more complicated because the emissions are released either in international waters in the case of shipping, or international airspace in the case of aviation. So other organizations need to be brought in to try and tackle those emissions, but not just other governance organizations, but of course companies, businesses, shipping, it's all about trade and global trade. So how do we incentivize and change a system that is very complex in relation to shipping, has multiple actors, and you then need to drive those emissions down at a scale and a pace that is completely unprecedented? And that's where my research is focused.
Okay, well, thank you. And I think we'll jump over to Harris to just get maybe a bit brief introduction to your involvement in this issue, Harris.
Yes, thanks, Kim. Like you say, I'm a maritime lawyer, and the immediate reaction of anyone listening is, what on earth do lawyers have to do with this? And I think the best way to explain it is to break it down. So what we call decarbonization, what people call decarbonization, is in effect three things. One is hardware, the quest for a new energy source. This has nothing to do with the work of lawyers like me. The next, second of the three aspects is policy, rules, regulations, In maritime, it would be the IMO. In other areas, it would be different regulators. This is not an area I'm an expert on. I'm not an expert on policy or regulations. But there is a third area, which is the need for carbon abatement, the need to reduce emissions from here and now and also tomorrow. And that dovetails with Alice's work. Now, committed emissions or cumulative emissions. Now, in terms of carbon efficiency or energy efficiency, the most important and the most impactful aspect is contracts. And that's my area of expertise. So it is contracts that will deliver the changes necessary for the industry, and we're talking about maritime here, for maritime trade to reduce its carbon footprint in a meaningful way this decade and beyond. So as a maritime lawyer, I specialize in contracts, and my area of focus is on decarbonization, is this very, very narrow thing, the third of the three elements.
Okay, I think this does dovetail certainly into what Alice was saying about this being outside the purview of a particular nation. And that's where contract comes in. If we're going to make changes, it has to be through contracts between the various stakeholders in the maritime adventure, as they say. But let's just let's circle back a little bit to Alice's work with what you term committed emissions. And Alice Harris sent me the BMC Energy article, Shipping and the Paris Climate Agreement, a focus on committed emissions. So I struggled through that. But I think the kind of the number that caught my eye was the estimated baseline for committed emissions in shipping as 85 to 212% of the carbon budget for 1.5 centigrades. Could you explain what those numbers mean?
Yeah, so we have in shipping infrastructure, in ships themselves, we have an asset that lasts a long time. Is a really fundamental part of trying to understand this phrase committed emissions. So when we have ships that last a long time, it means that the technologies that were within those ships and those ships themselves are going to be sailing for a very long time. And I think that the typical scrappage age, it varies depending on the kind of ship you're talking about, but something of the order of near 30 years or so, the lifetime of the ship. And that means that if you look at the, we often talk about new technologies and new ship designs and new things that we can use in the either the engines or in the design of the hull, et cetera, et cetera. And that's great, thinking about those new technologies for new ships in the future. And we will need new ships and we will need new designs and more efficient ships. But we are going to be sailing much of the fleet that exists today for a considerable amount of time, for some decades to come in some cases. And that means that there is a certain amount of carbon dioxide emissions that we can estimate based on assumptions that we know the efficiency of these ships, we know the typical journeys that these ships might be sailing. We know at the moment, these ships are burning diesel fuel. There are lots of discussions about new and alternative fuels, and there is a discussion about retrofitting these ships or some of these ships. But at the moment, the direction of travel is that the technology isn't going to shift an awful lot for the ships that we have in the existing fleet. And so what the paper has done is it made assumptions about the ships, looked at the different kind of ship categories. And we did only look at this is just from an EU perspective, because that was the data set that was available. But just estimated, if these ships are continuing to sail at the estimated lifetimes that it would be expected for the ships of that we have sailing currently, and if they're using that those fuels, the conventional fuels, then of the available carbon budget that is a fair share for the shipping sector, how much of that would be taken up by the existing ships? So before we start thinking about new fuels, new ships being designed. And the figures that you refer to essentially are indicating that we are close to or exceeding the actual budget that's available for a 1.5 degree of warming, which is that temperature that is noted within the Paris Climate Agreement. So we have, in other words, you have to do something with the existing ships. They have to operate in a different way or more efficiently, much more efficiently. Or we need to retrofit those ships with technologies that allow them to use less fuel or use different fuels if you're going to not breach that limit, that budget that is available for a fair share for shipping to make its kind of fair, play its fair part, if you like, in dealing with climate change.
So basically what you're saying is that we need to make some changes, and we need to make them quickly.
Urgency is the thing. I mean, it has to happen in a time frame of years, not decades, and it needs to be with the technologies that we have. We might be able to retrofit some of these ships, but using them differently. Slow steaming is an obvious example where you can, you know, you have a cubed relationship between the speed of a ship and the fuel consumed, approximately. So if you can operate the ships differently, then you will use a lot less fuel, and you will therefore release less CO2 emissions. So it's about what you can do in the short term with what you've got is what we're looking at here.
I think this is... works very nicely with what we want to discuss with Harris about the Blue Visby solution. But before sort of jumping into that, I just wanted to mention GARD's experience. We're part of the Poseidon Principles for Marine Insurance. And what we're doing is we are tracking and reporting publicly the climate impact of our hull and machinery portfolio, not our P&I, but our hull and machinery. And there are a number of other insurers that are doing this as well. And the Poseidon Principles reports on this. And the first report came out fairly recently. And the only good news for GARD was is that we do better than the average. But the bad news for everybody was that the average is 12.7% above the trajectory for the IMO, 50% reduction by 2050. So that's not even net zero. That's just the IMO. So
yes, and I think just if I could jump in there as well. I mean, I think that, you know, you mentioned then the IMO target for 2050, which is not anywhere near strong enough to be compatible with the Paris Climate Agreement as well. So, you know, where we're aiming for at the moment is not going to get us where we need to be in terms of climate terms.
I think there's a lot of folks that agree with you on that. So we're looking at the IMO to make some changes on that goal. But anyway, let's shift a little bit and hear from Harris about the Blue Visby solution, which certainly looks very promising in that it is a solution that does not require retrofitting. To reduce by up to 15% carbon emissions. So let's hear what the magic is, Harris.
There is no magic. It's simply a matter of identifying a particular inefficiency. It's a matter of understanding why it's there. What are the elements? What are the obstacles that you need to overcome to resolve it? Now, the inefficiency we're looking at, and this is the only and exclusive aim of the Blue Visby solution, the inefficiency is the operational practice of cargo ships that steam from one port to the next port without reference to the conditions in that port, or without reference to the conditions or the location of all the other ships that steam to the same destination. That is the practice we call, in code, sail fast then wait, or steam fast then wait. Now, the clue is in the choice of verb. That practice dates back to the age of sail. So it has survived the age of sail, it has survived the age of steam, it has survived several technological revolutions, and yet ships still today sail fast, then wait. Now, the scientists have known for a very, very long time, they've calculated, this research goes back decades, they've calculated that if you somehow remove that inefficiency and you allow every ship to go straight to berth, no waiting at all, you would save something in the order of 20%. Precisely because you would achieve a slower speed. And like Alice says, the rule of the cube, for every unit of speed, you need 3 units of fuel. That's how I understand it as a lawyer. And you get big efficiencies through removing this dysfunction, if you like. Now, the reason why this dysfunction exists is partly tradition. That's how we've always done things, and we like that in maritime. It's partly the absence of technology. And I will only say something about this very briefly. It is only in the last 10, 20 years that satellite coverage has extended to the point where you can actually see where ships are with precision. This surprises people, but you know, masters, today's captains, used to carry a sextant to take their position and understand where they are and so on. So technology evolved not very long ago. We're talking a couple of decades. But the most important obstacle is, in fact, not tradition, not technology, it's the contracts. Our contracts, just like our practices, just like our ships, go back to the age of sail, the age of steam. Our contracts are not designed for carbon efficiency. They're designed for other types of commercial needs or other types of efficiency. Kim, you know very well, we have things like speed and performance warranties. Slow steaming would be a case of deviation. It would be a breach of contract. We have ways to reward inefficiency. We financially reward inefficiency through the scheme of laytime and demurrage in voyage charters. So we have a whole contractual architecture that is almost rigged against carbon efficiency. And that's how you solve this problem. You have to reconfigure your contracts. So the Blue Visby solution then looks at all those obstacles, and the elements of the solution are partly technological, algorithms, partly operational, something that looks like air traffic control, and partly contractual. So we have designed the contracts necessary to underpin the system, to make the system work. Key to the contractual architecture is one element, which is also commercially attractive. We have built into the system a mechanism, a contractual mechanism, for sharing the costs and benefits of deploying the Blue Visby solution. And we do this for a very pragmatic, you could say cynical reason. We do not appeal to the good nature of the industry participants. We don't say to them, you have to do this for the environment, because that may not work. We say to them, you have to do this because you will make money. You will save money. There will be savings. You'll have to share the savings, but those savings are only available if you play nicely. If you share, if you don't share, the saving is not there. So that may sound unrealistic, but it's not, for the reason that we have modeled a sharing mechanism on an existing structure, which you, Kim, know very well, every maritime lawyer knows very well, called general average. So we have deployed a well-established, in fact, an ancient system of sharing costs. We have adapted that system to share costs as well as benefits. And we call it the Blue GA. And that is a system that gives everyone a skin in the game. It gives everyone an incentive to participate. And it's familiar. Everybody knows what general average does. So it's operations. It's technology, but fundamentally, it's about a new contractual architecture. or a different and adapted, a tweaked contractual architecture?
Let me just ask you, you know, I've been reading about sort of just-in-time arrival, which is sort of looking at the same issue and using the same type of satellite technology and the ability to know where ships are. And that is something that is put together by the Global Maritime Energy Efficiency Partnership and the Global Industry Alliance to Support Low Carbon Shipping. And what was interesting to me is, you know, this is the same sort of concept, and that is to optimize the voyage and eliminate the waiting time for services at the berth. But the interesting thing in this was they sort of said, well, you know, forget about voyage charters because of the demurrage incentive, and let's concentrate on container ships, because these are the ships that are owned and time chartered. So, I mean, is, you know, I've heard you speak several times and you talk about slaying the dragon. Is demurrage the dragon that needs to be slayed?
It is a dragon, but we would rather tame the dragon.
Tame the dragon.
We can tame the dragon. We don't have to kill the dragon. We can tame the dragon, because if you kill the dragon, people will lose money. Mm. And it's better to tame the dragon and maybe reduce its size, but still allow room for profit. But before I come on to that, if I may say, because it's important to distinguish between the Blue Visby solution and just-in-time. By just-in-time, we really mean just-in-time berthing. Now, to achieve just-in-time berthing, a system where ships go straight to berth, a little bit like a perfect air traffic control, where aeroplanes do not take off until they know there's a slot for them to land and they go straight into land. That is not feasible in maritime trade. It would be fantastic, but it is not feasible, and certainly not in the time scale that we're looking at. There is no port in the world that has adopted a entirely successful just-in-time system. Two ports stand out, Rotterdam and Newcastle in Australia. We can talk about it later, but why is it that just-in-time is different to Blue Visby? Just-in-time berthing requires the coordination of a multitude of actors who affect berthing at the port. Every port has an ecosystem: terminals, pilots, tugs, customs, the trains, all of those elements that need to be coordinated in order for ships to berth just in time. In our project, in the Blue Visby project, we say this is not a shipping problem. Just-in-time berthing requires port coordination. We cannot solve that. We in the shipping industry, we cannot solve ports. And every port is different. Even if you solve one, you can solve one, Rotterdam, you cannot solve the other. But fundamentally, we the shipping industry, cannot solve the ports. So what the Blue Visby solution does is to sidestep berthing by optimizing only the ocean passage. You can think of it as pilot station to pilot station. The system, the algorithm, the operations deliver the group of ships in a systemic fashion, in an orderly way, to the anchorage or to a position near the anchorage. From that point onwards, it's up to every particular port to organize its own ecosystem, solve its own dysfunctions. And if they can get just-in-time berthing, fantastic. If they cannot, it doesn't matter, because we have still delivered a massive saving from the ocean passage. So we have the studies that show that optimizing the ocean passage delivers 16% savings on average or median. Getting to a perfect just-in-time delivers 20% savings. So those additional 4 percentage points we leave on the table. We treat that as a last mile problem. We leave that for the ports to organize. All we do is the ocean passage. So in this way, the Blue Visby solution is entirely consistent and compatible with just-in-time systems that ports operate. We do a different job. We just look at the ocean passage. So that's the difference with just-in-time. Now, for the dragon, so if the marriage is the dragon, it is an obstacle. So in time charters, you don't have that problem. The contracts can be more easily tweaked. For voyage charters, you have that problem. The marriage is an obstacle. But through our sharing mechanism, we share the benefit, we share whatever sacrifice of the marriage there might be. And in that way, you incentivize the removal of that obstacle. There will still be demarriage, and there will still be a little bit of delay, but it doesn't have to be 50 days of delay. That's the point of on the demarriage front.
Looking at the technology, you can see ships where they are using the AIS transmissions. So you can see in real time where ships are in, you know, in route. How does it work if you have a Blue Visby ship, you know, in a group of 10 and it's the only one? Do you need some kind of penetration of the system in the group of ships for it to be worthwhile? Or is it, you know, is it going to build up gradually one ship owner at a time?
It's absolutely right. So there are different layers to the question or to the answer. Maybe the first layer to start from is segments. The Blue Visby solution addresses segments, not ships, because it is segments that operate as a group. Or if you look at a lane, a trade, or at the port, you have different terminals for different types of commodities, for different types of ships. So you will need a level of penetration within a segment. That's point number one. Now, what is that level of penetration? That question has a commercial angle and a mathematical angle. We have on our team a mathematician who is preparing a master's thesis on this very question. The title of the master's thesis is Levels of Penetration in the Blue Visby Solution. So you can model it mathematically. And what I mean is this. If you have a group of 50 ships that are steaming to the same port, they are all in different positions. The system will not work if the positions are such that non-participants can game the system and jump the queue. So penetration is really a question for queue jumping. How do you stop non-participants from jumping the queue? Because if they cannot jump the queue, it doesn't matter that they don't participate. The participants reap the benefits, and the others who do not participate just waste more fuel, but they don't jump the queue. So there's a mathematical element there. And then there's a commercial element, which is how do you incentivize all those people or a majority of the segment at any one time to participate? And that question can be answered through CII for ships, through Scope 3 for charterers, through Scope 3 and other measures for the ports. So there will come a point where participation reaches a tipping point perhaps, and becomes widespread. Until it becomes widespread, to the extent that there's no queue jumping, even a small number of participants will have a benefit. But it will be a smaller benefit. It will not be 15%. It may be 2, 3, 4, 5%, depending on the trade, depending on the density of the route, depending on the time of year, and so on. So layers, segments matter, mathematics matter. If the ships are spaced out, queue jumping is not easy, so the system can deliver the benefits, even for the smaller number of people. And then there's a commercial layer, which is how do you incentivize penetration? But penetration is not binary. It is not 15% with 100% penetration or nothing. It will be a sliding scale, if you like, of increasing benefits the higher the penetration.
Alice, let's turn back to you. I'd like your view as a climate scientist. Is the Blue Visby solution a way to reduce committed emissions in the existing fleet?
Yes, I mean, I think the Blue Visby solution is proposing. I mean, it sounds, you know, very positive and very much aligned with the kind of thing that we need to be thinking. You know, we need to be thinking much more innovatively about what we can do with our existing technologies, our existing, you know, transports, and, you know, shipping is the example here. And if we can change the way things operate, the way things work, you know, things are going to become more difficult, more expensive in all sectors because of the way we need to decarbonize. You know, we need, you know, new fuels are not going to be cheaper. They're going to be more expensive. They're going to take more energy to convert. So all sectors, and shipping is a really great example, going to need to look at making massive efficiencies. You know, I'm not an economist, but from an economics point of view, from a financial point of view, you know, this decarbonized world is going to be challenging in terms of the economics and the finances. So you have to do something to make these ships more efficient and to operate more efficiently. So if there's a solution here that can actually make a significant change, and 15% is a very large percentage of emission savings if that could be delivered. That sounds really exciting, really important, because it can also deliver change in the short term. You're not waiting for something to be developed and upscaled, you know, from a lab, which is often the kinds of things that we hear about in this kind of space when talking about decarbonisation. So such a solution would be fantastic if we can make it work.
Tell me a little bit about the timeline. This is in a pilot stage, correct?
Yes. So it's in fact three separate pilot stages. Over the last two and a half, three years, there have been a number of studies, and we work on the basis of those studies. We call them proofs of concept. Since last summer, we started a pilot program, which involves three separate pilot programs. The first is that we take vessels of our consortium participants. There is a digital twin of that vessel, and the operators of the system, the software, and the people who do the operations issue instructions to the digital twin, if you like, pretend instructions in the virtual world that affect the behavior of the digital twin. So imagine a group of ships that steams today to the port of Rotterdam, and one of those ships exists in two universes, in the real universe and in the digital twin. And you see how the digital twin, which follows the instructions of the Blue Visibility system, behaves. And we can check the behavior, test the system, test the software, identify the savings, the flaws, and so on and so forth. So that's the virtual pilot, the digital twin pilot. Then there is a separate pilot, which I think the team calls the internal pilot, which is a particular lane that is, by lane, I mean a couple of ports, a load port and a discharge port. In that lane, the software, the system in the background constantly creates an optimization system. So the system constantly optimizes the vessel that ply the route, without digital twins, without issuing any instructions to anybody. This is there to collect more data points. And the third system, the third pilot, is what the scientists call a stochastic pilot, which, if I understand it correctly, means that it creates statistics. It's not statistic pilot, it's called stochastic pilot. It generates statistics for more data crunching. All of that is progressing, and the aim for this year, the aim for 23, is to build on the three pilots to create a prototype. The prototype will differ from the pilots in that it will be real world. So the pilots are all in a virtual environment. We do not change the way ships behave, the actual ships. The prototype will involve instructions to ships, particular ships, will involve an early version of an association so that people play nicely together. So it will involve all the aspects of the Blue Visibility solution, but for a tight group, for a short period of time, it will look like a microcosm of a fully deployed Blue Visby. That will be rolled out in a particular part of the world, and we're in discussions with different stakeholders in different parts of the world, in a particular segment. And if that prototype goes well, it will give both the team and also the industry the confidence that this is real world, it's not just something on a computer. And money will change hands. So Blue GA will operate.
So we're going to have to go from FD&D lawyers to average adjusters?
Good question. the contraction architecture, of course, Kim, you will find that very appealing, both personally and as guard. The contraction architecture includes a bespoke dispute resolution mechanism. Because we're all pragmatic, cynical industry insiders, we understand that disputes are part of the game. We understand that the system will need to evolve through disputes. We cannot design a perfect system, right? So it's evolution, it's not intelligent design. So there will be types of disputes around how you share the spoils, whether you gave people the correct queue number, but fundamentally, we are trying to build a system that is neutral, that is transparent, that operates for the benefit of the industry, not for the benefit of a particular type of participant. And if it generates disputes, which it will, those disputes will support the evolution. So there will be a future where there will be a Blue Visby section of guard handling. But hopefully it will be a very boring section of guard with very little work.
That sounds like paradise to me. So I want to thank you, and I want to thank Alice for participating.
Thank you very much, Kim. And it was very nice to see you, Alice.
Nice to see you, Harris.
Good to see you, Alice.
Thank you so much, Alice.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.